Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on today's show, we have my co-presenter and co-producer, John Dorney. We're going to be interviewing him for a change. His new book, Peace After the Final Battle, The Story of the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1924, is on sale in all good bookshops now at the moment from New Ireland Press. So we're going to ask him some questions about that, and if you have any questions about the show, please email us on history@near.ie. Or you could contact us through the website on Facebook at facebook.com/The Irish History Show. To start with, why 1912 as a starting point?
Why 1912? Well, the obvious reason is because 1912 is when the Third Home Rule Bill comes before the British Parliament. So it's the start of, if you like, the ferment that ends in 1923-24 with the establishment of two new states in Ireland. The Irish Free State and Northern Ireland. Not quite a state, Northern Ireland, but almost a state. So 1912 is a good place to start for that reason. In fact, you have to start there. Another reason is because 1912 is a little bit like the calm before the storm. So you get to talk a little bit about what Ireland was like under British rule. I actually went back further in the first chapter and go back to the 19th century and before. But one of the things which I was interested in doing in the book, because the book is supposed to be an overview of the Irish Revolution and how the two polities, if you like, that we have in Ireland came to be formed. So if you're going to understand that, and if you're going to criticise or praise what the independent Irish state has done, you have to know what British rule was like before in its, you know, its achievements. It had some achievements and its faults as well. And its faults probably haven't gotten enough press of late. So that's the reason mainly for starting in 1912.
And what attracted you to this period? Because originally you started off as an early modern scholar.
That's right. Well, the main reason, I think, is because you don't feel the same kind of intimate connection with the early modern period as a way of kind of explaining what Ireland is like now. The early modern period is very interesting, and it's very good, actually, as a lecturer of mine once said, to study something that you're not familiar with at all, like the 17th century, where the rules of the game, the rules of life and politics and everything else are totally different. And that definitely broadens your horizon. But in travelling around Ireland, like I lived in Galway for a little while and travelled around Ireland a bit, you started to see, and that, you know, there's little memorials everywhere in Ireland to the War of Independence and the Civil War. There are little reminders everywhere you go, almost in Ireland, of the revolutionary period. Especially where I lived, where I grew up, in Dublin, in Rathfarnham, on the south side, sorry, Near FM listeners, There's a memorial to a guy called Frank Lawler. And my dad always pointed this out as I was growing up, and he always called the place where the memorial is Ambush Corner, because he said he was killed laying an ambush for the Black and Tans, and he was killed in action. And eventually, when I came to look into this, it turned out that Frank Lawler was actually anti-treaty Republican who was murdered, and I say murdered because he was abducted and he was shot in the head, by pro-treaty Free State forces during the Civil War. This really piqued my interest because I said, if our family, we got that wrong, what else have people got wrong? What else don't people remember? What have they chosen to forgotten about the revolutionary period? Another reason is because even though I didn't, when I was in university, I didn't specialise in the study of early 20th century Irish history. It was always present in various other courses. And various tropes that people were discussing in the late 90s and the 2000s were always present. Well, okay, there's the straightforward nationalist narrative, which was kind of out of fashion at the time, which was that, you know, Ireland had a long struggle for freedom and it freed itself from the shackles of British rule. And the modern version of that kind of went like Irish democracy was kind of validated in the revolution. But this is also the kind of tail end of the Troubles. And there's also an idea floating around in Southern Irish discourse that the violence that was used in the revolutionary period, the Republican violence, was totally unnecessary. That Home Rule was the logical, the constitutional end to Irish grievances. That we would have all been much better if this had never happened, you know, and there's various versions of this in popular culture and also in kind of academia. So you couldn't help but notice these things even then, even if you weren't a specialist in it, in the topic.
It's funny you should mention that, because the Sunday Independent had an article there about 2 weeks ago talking about the unnecessary 1916 revolution, but then goes on to say Sinn Féin would have swept the boards in 1918. They could have had a non-violent civil disobedience afterwards. Did you find when you were doing the research that each event leads on to the next? You couldn't really have one without the other.
You know, when you start using the term would have in history, you're always going to be in shaky ground, because it's an obvious thing to say, but we really don't know what would have happened. Nobody ever does. But having said that, are there reasons for all the things that happen? Are there kind of underlying causes? And there are, you know. Would Sinn Féin have swept the board, for example, in 1918? Would they have won that general election and declared Irish independence? without the Rising? Well, there's a number of factors in favour of Sinn Féin or another more radical party that would have cut the ground away from the Irish Parliamentary Party, who had been campaigning for Home Rule, who were very much of the belief that they were working within the law, within the British Constitution, and quite a lot of whom wanted Ireland to be part of the British Empire, and were happy about that. One reason was that there was the extension of the franchise in 1918. So something like at least, at the minimum, 80% of the electorate in 1918 were new voters who had never been tied into the Irish parliamentary machine. I think that's been underestimated before. That's one reason. The First World War by 1918 was incredibly unpopular in Ireland. People didn't want to be conscripted. And the conscription crisis of 1918 was the making of Sinn Féin in a lot of ways. The war itself imposed a lot of hardship. People were reacting against that. Things like land reform, the Congested Districts Board and the Land Reform Commission, things like that were shut down during the war for lack of funds. So Sinn Féin got the traditional rural protest vote, people who wanted to buy their own land and to buy out the remaining landlords. During the war, there was also increased British repression. Anyway, even before the Rising, there was a certain amount. Now, that said, the Rising did do a lot of things. I'm not that interested in the moral arguments about the Rising, because I think that's sort of an argument for philosophers. But as historians, like, what effect did the Rising have? The Rising did produce a new cohort, if you like, of very radicalised, very committed activists. Not only the people who'd been to jail, there were about 1,000 of them who had taken part in the Rising and had been to jail. The volunteers who wanted to come out in 1916, but then went home again because of how botched the Rising actually was. Even wider again, the people who were just, in, not so much in the Rising, of course, but after the Rising, very impressed with the commitment and the bravery shown by the Rising, and who were outraged at the response, particularly the execution of the leaders and the internment. Remember, there were something like 3,000 people interned after the Rising. So I don't really think it's possible to talk about this would have happened, this wouldn't have happened, because we can never know. What I tried to do in the book was show that there are, as well as the dramatic events that everybody's familiar with, there are kind of background reasons, and yet, you know, you can't dismiss the traditional explanations either, you know, such as the Easter Rising, for example.
Now, it's a huge undertaking to cover all the events of Irish history between 1912 and 1924. And when you were doing your research, you must have obviously read an awful lot of secondary sources and previous people's books who've written about 1916 or the First World War or the Civil War. When you were reading those books, was there anything in them that made you think, I need to write my own version, or they haven't covered this subject? Or does it frustrate you in a way, reading somebody who doesn't cover or doesn't put an important emphasis on something you think is quite central to the story of that period?
Yeah, there were some points like that which I felt haven't been properly teased out. But it's not a book against other historians. I'm not saying whatever everyone has written before was wrong. And like you said, because this is a general history, a lot of what I wrote in the book has relied on what other people have written. So I don't want to be one of these cases where the establishment historians say this, but I say this. But having said that, okay, points which I think haven't been stressed enough in the past. One of them is the franchise. I never realised before doing the research was how limited the franchise really was. Like, people talk about the democratisation of Ireland in the late 19th century, but about 30% of men, generally speaking, had the vote in the last election before the First World War, which was 1911, which is a pretty small number. And that's about 15% of the actual adult population. And in the corporation, roughly in Dublin City, because the population of Dublin County, like now, was actually considerably bigger. It was Dublin kind of urban area is about 500,000 at the time. Dublin City is roughly 300,000. Now, of them, about 30,000 to 40,000 people have the vote before the First World War. That's about 10%. So that's a really significant factor that people, I don't think, have emphasised. Things like the land question, one of the things which I have kind of temporarily put aside, although I included a bit in the book, was research on the North Midlands and the border counties during the independence period. Well, one thing that struck me so obviously, really, reading through the local papers especially, was how important the land question still was. Because kind of one of the commonplaces of this period is that after the land war of the 1880s and the Windham Act of 1908, when tenants got the right to buy their own land, that the land question was resolved and everyone was happy on the land in Ireland, and the only problems left were the cities and the slums. That's kind of a cliche in Irish history. That's simply not true at all. Especially in the poorer counties, tenants just didn't have the capital to buy their land. I mean, yes, they got long-term loans, but the landlord had to be prepared to sell in the first place, and a lot of them simply weren't. So there still were quite a few landlords of the old style about. I'm talking like Anglo-Irish types, often former military types, who didn't live in the country, and they represented by agents who were often lawyers living in Dublin. And as late as 1922-23, like in, during the Civil War, the land question is still huge. Like, it's still probably the biggest single election issue in 1923, for example, up in Cavan, Monaghan. And the same is true, I think, in places like Sligo and Galway and Mayo and West Cork. That's another thing. The labour question. Now, the labour question hasn't been neglected in sort of labour history circles. Outside of that, and people like who've written general histories, like Michael Hopkinson, whose work, by the way, I recommend, have mentioned it, but I think underplayed it. Hopkinson says things like, the Civil War didn't happen in this place apart from some social unrest to do with labour and land. While my book isn't a detailed exposition of that stuff, I think that's not really good enough to say that, because that's also part of the story. Maybe it's not the part of the nationalist, the state-building story, but that doesn't mean it's not important. I think you have to include those details as well. So in my book, I talk quite a lot about the development of the labour movement and the part they played in the independence struggle, and the part, the sort of failure of the labour movement in 1922-23 to play a significant role even in the Civil War is also important. Likewise, in the land question, how it's settled is also important. And finally, about the Civil War itself, the Civil War itself has had remarkably little scholarship on it compared to the War of Independence. And there's obvious reasons for that, because people don't like to remember how nasty it was. The other reason is that it's sort of politically inconvenient even now for any party which has governed the Irish state or aspires to, because the Irish Civil War is a period in which the state forces committed probably more violence, and certainly more what some of the people have called transgressive violence. This means that violence which would be against the laws of war. The laws of war weren't really enforced because it was a civil war, but the nastiness of the Civil War, particularly in the government side, has in recent years certainly, I'm told this was different way back, but in recent years certainly has not been looked into at all. And there's, again, my book isn't long enough to really tease this out in detail, but it certainly includes the story of the bitterness and the nastiness of the Civil War on both sides, but particularly on the government side, which is kind of a neglected story, I think.
Well, when you started researching this period, not just for the book, but previous e-books you've written and for articles on the Irish story, were you surprised, were you taken aback at some of your research, that things you had believed to be true turned out not to be the case at all, or facts that you came across were quite surprising?
Yeah, like, one of the kind of things, and here I have to kind of agree with a certain amount of the secondary literature that's been written, especially about the War of Independence. The War of Independence is not really a military story, primarily. Without taking anything away from the bravery and the commitment of the IRA volunteers of that era, they never had the capacity to launch a really military campaign against the British Army, and only in some areas, particularly in Cork, was it anything like that. And what it is elsewhere is kind of, it's much more a campaign of political violence, of intimidation and blocking roads and trying to kind of neutralise the state, disable the state. But it's not really a question of battles. Like, there, ambushes and battles of small kind did occur, but that did surprise me, especially when you look on the ground. At first it surprised me that actual combat is on a large scale. I mean, the shots are exchanged all the time, but battles are pretty rare in the War of Independence. There's probably more in the Civil War, although the casualties were smaller. That was another thing that surprised me. It's kind of a cliche of Irish nationalist history that more people were killed in the Civil War. Now, I still don't have an exact hard number, but I do have a kind of round number for casualties in the Civil War. They're about 1,500, which is fewer. It's considerably fewer than the War of Independence. So that was another thing that surprised me, because, again, it's a cliche of Irish history that the Civil War was so bitter and more people were lost in this terrible, wasteful conflict. But actually, whatever you make of it, that's not true. That surprised me. Another thing that surprised me when looking at the career of individual Republicans, this was a few years ago I started doing this, looking at Peter Paul Galligan, who was an IRB member, Sinn Féin. Well, no, he was IRB and volunteer member, and later on a Sinn Féin member. So looking in detail at his letters and his correspondence and stuff like that, and then looking at other things, was how basically conservative even a lot of the pre-war IRB radicals were. I mean, they were committed and militant on Irish independence. In all other ways, they were mainstream Irish Catholic nationalists. There were, of course, some, like Ernest Blythe, for example, who wrote some surprisingly radical articles about socialism in Irish Freedom, the IRB journal. But in general, I was surprised to find how socially conservative a lot of them were. Like, for example, Galligan was a TD fairly briefly in the Free State in 1922. And he didn't stand, actually, in the election of 1922. But in the 6 months where he was a member of the Dáil there, he supported, one of the only things that he did was vote for a bill to support conscription of immoral films, you know, in the Free State. And that was what their vision of Irish freedom looked like, I guess. So, like, although there are radicals, but I think the idea that the kind of the radical revolution was betrayed, and that the good radicals who had been Republican all along were ousted by kind of pro-treaty neo-Redmondites, it's a good story, and it makes a certain amount of sense. It's not really true, I don't think. So that's another thing that surprised me.
What do you think about the attempt, perhaps, to rehabilitate Redmond that's going on now at the moment, especially with the centenary of the start of the First World War. When you look back at that 1912 period, your book starts off really with the Sword Home Rule Bill and the failure of Redmond and the party to deliver on the Sword Home Rule Bill. What impression do you get of Redmond as a character?
Well, Redmond was a veteran politician, and that means that he was used to the kind of life of give and take in Westminster, of compromises. When you look at what Redmond was saying at the time of the Third Home Rule Bill, some of it's laudable. Like, some of it's like about how Ulster Unionists, for example, have nothing to fear in a Home Rule ruled Ireland or an Irish Parliament, an autonomous Irish Parliament. How Irishmen have never been into religious bigotry. Those are not his exact words, but, you know, things like this. So some of it's laudable. Redmond was a man who was very integrated into the British political scene. And his wife was English. Not that that, you know, should be held against him at all, but Redmond explicitly said during the debates for the Third Home Rule Bill, while he was trying to kind of conciliate and reassure unionists, that Home Rule did not mean Irish independence. So what's kind of interesting is that the version now is that John Redmond was Michael Collins before 1922, you know, that John Redmond would have delivered Irish independence. That's not true. John Redmond said, I want Ireland to be part of the British Empire. I don't want Ireland to separate from the British Empire. Home Rule at first was going to be very limited. It wasn't going to have control over the police, the army, the borders, the currency, the taxes. I mean, they were going to get their budget from Westminster every year. Now, Redmond, to give him his due on this, did say down the line, we can work on these things within the system. But that's what Redmond was about. I mean, Redmond, he was a politician who believed in the connection between Britain and Ireland, although he wanted an autonomous Irish Parliament. Certainly, I mean, the Redmond who I see is the old Redmond, the veteran Redmond. I mean, Redmond, he did go to jail in his early years in the land struggles. So maybe there was a younger radical Redmond. I'm not the person to ask about that, unfortunately. But the other thing is, like Katrina Crowe, for example, the head of the National Archives, said on a recent RTÉ programme that she viewed the decade from 1912 to 22, and of course it's actually 11 years because it goes on to 23 and really goes on to 24. So it's the dozen of commemoration, really. But anyway, Katrina Crowe said she saw it as the decade of death, referring to political violence in Ireland. Now, the fact is that roughly 5,000 people, it might not, now give or take, it might be a little over, a little under, roughly 5,000 people died in political violence in the island of Ireland in that decade, 1912 to 22. Okay, and 23, 24, okay. At least 27,000 and probably 35,000 Irishmen died in the First World War at Redmond's bidding. So if people want to talk about politicians who are against violence and against militarism, I mean, Redmond has to be considered in that light, that he recommended and campaigned for recruiting for Irish men to go to the First World War, where tens of thousands of them were killed. So at least six times as many Irishmen were killed in the First World War as were killed in political violence in Ireland. Although, I mean, the kind of shadow of the troubles, the more recent troubles in Northern Ireland, still hang over our debate here, because people are saying, well, if political violence was okay back then, or if you downplay it, then you approve of political violence now in Northern Ireland. Now, as the troubles kind of recede into the past a little bit, we can get away from that. But the fact of the matter is that political violence in Ireland claimed a lot less people than the First World War. So Redmond's record has to be evaluated in that light as well. You know, Redmond was not a bad man. He believed in what he was doing. He wasn't a sectarian man. He believed in an inclusive Ireland. Like most parliamentary party figures, he wasn't keen on things like universal suffrage. He wasn't keen on vote for women, really, although John Dillon was even more critical of it. He was in favour of the imperial connection, and he was in favour of Irish participation in the First World War. People can make their own judgment on that, but I think that Redmond's context, his time and his actual views should be borne in mind.
When you look at pre-war Ireland, and by pre-war I mean prior to 1914, is it recognisable in any way, particularly Dublin? Is it recognisable to today?
Yeah, you know, a lot of Ireland, and particularly Dublin, kind of makes a lot more sense when you appreciate the British context. You know, because Dublin and Ireland was shaped in the British model. And all of our institutions, more or less, that's another kind of conclusion of the book, kind of continued more or less intact, with the odd exception, like the Gardaí and the Army, really, and the actual Oireachtas, of course, in the system of government. And even there are a lot of continuities because of the civil service, which remained intact. Even down to the street names and down to the architecture of Dublin, of inner city Dublin. And around the country, the things like the rail lines, when you appreciate the kind of British context, it does come a lot more to focus. So even getting away from, say, the revolutionary period, which of course is a rejection of the British dimension of the Irish experience, I think now one of the things that we should do is sort of appreciate, now I'm not saying here good or bad or saying, you know, rejoin the Commonwealth or whatever, but, you know, Ireland was shaped in the British image and it has a lot in common with the kind of social history of Britain. Now, having said that, the actual British rule in Ireland was something that was quite unfamiliar to us and quite alien to us. Things like the way Ireland was governed, because Ireland was governed obviously by the Chief Secretary for Ireland, who was a British appointee, the Under Secretary, who was a British civil servant, and the Lord Lieutenant, who lived in the Phoenix Park, in the same place where the President now lives, now called Áras an Uachtaráin, was the Viceregal Lodge in those days. That stuff is feels very alien to modern Irish people. Likewise, the prominence of things like the British Army, had barracks all over Ireland. The Irish Army took them over later, but a lot of them are closed down now. And they used to parade in towns. This was a common thing, like in garrison towns, not only in Dublin, obviously, but also in places like Sligo, Athlone, the Curragh, Kildare, Cork, you know. Like, this was part of the fabric of life in a way that it still is in the United Kingdom, but isn't in Ireland at all, because even the Irish Army isn't as visible as that. The imperial references that, for example, if you read the memoirs of people like Sean O'Foylan and Frank O'Connor, who were both from Cork, the references to the Empire, a lot of the sort of elite schools in Ireland, like Blackrock College is the prime example, were founded originally to help young and middle-class Catholics graduate into the Imperial Civil Service, if not in Ireland, then in somewhere like India. So the kind of casual familiarity with the Empire, that's long gone now. You know, looking back, the idea that you can reject everything that happened prior to 1922 in Ireland is ridiculous, you know, because Ireland was shaped by the British experience. But in terms of, does it feel like an alien world? In some ways, it does. Because culturally, if you like, in terms of day-to-day life and political culture, they probably stayed for a couple of decades after Irish independence. But certainly now, a lot of the things which would have been normal to Irish people then and even to British people today are gone. And of course, you have 100 years in between as well. So life was obviously very different in a lot of normal ways.
Now we're going to take a very quick break, John, and we'll be back after these messages. Now you're listening to the Irish History Show on Near FM. We're here with John Dorney, normally my co-presenter and co-producer, but he's here to discuss his new book, Peace After the Final Battle, The Story of the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1924. Now, John, one of the things from reading your book I thought was quite interesting is the idea of Ireland as a unitary country. Sometimes when you're reading histories of 1916, the War of Independence, the Civil War, it's almost as if partition has always existed. Can you really get an idea of the Ireland of this period if you just ignore the Northeast?
No, it's the short answer. No, of course not. I mean, Ireland had never been partitioned before. I mean, even then, there were kind of people like Michael Collins, for example, made a speech where he said, you know, Northeast Ulster is not where you see the Irishman at home kind of thing. You know, it's a different culture. And of course, that's probably more to do, to be honest, with the industrialisation of the Northeast of Ireland than it is to do with political culture, I would say. Though, obviously, the kind of Protestant Unionist tradition, which grew up especially over the 19th century, it existed before, but it kind of formed its Unionist dimension in the 19th century. Ulster Protestants saw themselves as Irish at the time, in a way that not all of them do today. Being Irish meant a different thing at the time. For example, the song The Sash, it starts off with, I'm an Orange man and from Erin's Isle I come. You know, and these were kind of uncontroversial things. The idea of the unity of Ireland, it was a commonplace at the time. In the history of the time, treating the North and the South as different and as completely separate and nothing to do with each other is simply ridiculous. Because although the pattern of events is different, basically because you've such a large unionist bloc in the North, and from the start they're mobilised to prevent Home Rule and then to kind of carve out their own semi-state or quasi-state, whatever term I should use. So the rhythm of events is different, the protagonists are different. But what's going on in the South is certainly affecting what's going on in the North and vice versa. One of the underappreciated things, I mean, everybody knows probably who studies Irish history knows about the Home Rule crisis. The Ulster Volunteers were formed to block Home Rule, and this led to the formation of the Irish Volunteers. Most people know about that. As the troubles developed, the story hasn't been as well written about. There was a lot of violence in Belfast. Belfast, after Cork and Dublin, was the most violent place on the island of Ireland during the Irish Revolutionary period. Over 500 people were killed in Belfast City, and almost all of them were killed in inner city Belfast, where more or less where nationalist Catholic areas border unionist areas. In response to the IRA campaign in the north, there were initially kind of mass attacks on Catholic neighbourhoods in the summer of 1920, and attacks also on Protestant trade unionists and Labour supporters, because they were, the Labour Party supported Home Rule and the Labour movement supported Home Rule. But in response to that, there was a Belfast boycott declared in the south, a boycott on northern goods. And that's, if you read like things like the Bureau of Military History, the witness statements of IRA members and Cumberland Man members, that was one of the major things that they were doing, you know, at the time, was intercepting and seizing Belfast goods, the Belfast boycott. which possibly had a kind of contradictory effect of isolating the Northeast and aiding the road to partition. But the other thing that's it's starting to be written about now and talked about now, but it's still probably in public discourse is underappreciated, is that in early 1922, with the Free State or the Provisional Government of the Free State formed, you had a border war, more or less, between Northern Ireland and the Free State. It was an irregular war. It was in some ways like what's going on now in Ukraine, where Russia is feeding in irregular, unidentified troops. Michael Collins was doing precisely the same, without getting into the ins and outs of that episode. But there's a border war basically going on between the North and the South in early 1922. And at the same time, this is the bloodiest period in Belfast. So like the story of how partition came about hasn't probably been told enough, and it's starting to be told more. Hopefully my book is some contribution to that. Oh. But the idea that partition is inevitable, and certainly that partition happened without major violence on the ground in the North, is wrong. And it's something that I tried to address in my book.
Well, I think it's interesting sometimes listening to unionist politicians or even unionist historians that when they refer to the Ulster Volunteer Force, the 36th Ulster Division, the Ulster Unionist Council, they don't really acknowledge the fact that when these bodies were set up, they were intended as 9-county Ulster bodies, not 6-county bodies.
Yeah, I mean, I'm straying into territory here where I'm not an expert, but my understanding is that quite early on in the Home Rule crisis, well, not early in the Home Rule crisis, but early in the story of the Irish Revolution, in around 1914, the Ulster Unionists made a strategic decision to sort of drop the counties where they were not in a majority, Cavan, Monaghan, Donegal, because they figured they couldn't hold them. You know, they wouldn't be able to dominate them like they would the rest of Ulster. But yeah, I mean, certainly the Protestants and the Unionists in those counties felt very betrayed. And I mean, up to 1920, when Northern Ireland was created, and December 1921, when Northern Ireland de facto got off the ground because powers over policing and various other things were passed to the Northern Ireland government, and before the signing of the treaty, it was certainly the hope of Protestants in the border counties, most Protestants, because some were nationalists, but most weren't, most were unionists. It was certainly their hope that they'd be included in Northern Ireland, or that Irish independence wouldn't be conceded. Like they were, the border Protestant communities were actually very disappointed in the treaty. Like they called it a sellout, and you know they said they were left behind. And interestingly, what they start to say is that they have no more time for the British government because the British government sold them out, sold them down the river, and that they said that they hoped to be good citizens of the new Irish Free State because the Free State had promised them, well, promised respect for property and a lack of discrimination. So that's what they start to radically change.
Well, could it be said that Craig and Carson sold them out also?
Craig and Carson, probably, yeah. I mean, less Carson than Craig, of course. Carson, who was from Dublin, wanted to use Ulster as a stick with which to beat the government and block Home Rule. And Craig was basically the architect of Northern Ireland. But yeah, certainly, I mean, of course, Craig did sell the Ulster Unionists who ended up in the Free State down the river.
I think this is another
thing. In their terms.
Yes, when we read in some history books about the violence ending with the truce, the War of Independence violence ending with the truce, that's really not the case at all in the North, is it?
No, I mean, it's the opposite of that is true in the North. More people died after the truce and before the outbreak of the Southern Civil War in what became Northern Ireland than died before it. The truce did radically reduce the level of violence in most of Ireland, but it had the opposite effect in the North for two reasons. Number one, the Unionists, as they have done for so and so many occasions, feared a sellout. But the other reason is that in early 1922, you had basically a nationalist government set up in Dublin, which is the only nationalist government ever to really sponsor a military campaign against the North of Ireland. How committed Michael Collins, of course, was behind this, the rest of the cabinet were not so crazy about it. How committed Collins really was to this campaign is something that people are discussing now. Kieran Glennon has a book out on this and he's working on it more, and they can discuss it more fully than I can with reference to cabinet debates and Collins' papers to IRA people and stuff. But the period between the end of the War of Independence and the start of the Civil War was certainly the most bloody in the North. It was also the period of the greatest uncertainty, like in the border counties. There weren't that many people killed in and around the border counties in this period. I mean, comparatively, there's about 100 or 200 probably in and all of the border. But the fear was certainly great. I mean, a lot of people, what the local papers talk about is people fleeing, Catholics fleeing south and Protestants fleeing north. There was intimidation on both sides of the border by the Beast Specials especially, which were the paramilitary police who were set up in Northern Ireland. But also, unfortunately, there was discrimination and there was intimidation by the IRA, particularly by refugees from Belfast who were fleeing to places like Dundalk, Cavan, Monaghan. You start to see stories in 1922 of how they're occupying houses and farms and calling on the local IRA to evict the Protestant owners as sort of revenge because they'd been burnt out of their homes in Belfast. Now, generally speaking, the IRA refused to do this, the local IRA, but it did happen. And there are also cases of things like the big houses, the country mansions up there in that part of the world being burnt down. And they appear to have been burnt down because Belfast refugees wanted to be housed there and they weren't allowed to, and then burnt it down afterwards. Again, these are kind of unknown stories. I don't get the chance to more than touch on them in this book because it's more of an overview. But certainly, yeah, the late 1921, early 1922 is a very violent time in the north of Ireland.
Now, moving on to the Civil War, when you're researching this period and reading through it, is it hard to put yourself in the frame of mind of the participants or the partisans on each side? What motivates them and why it led to violence?
Yeah, when I first came to this period, this Civil War seems completely inexplicable. And kind of part of the discourse about this was the Civil War was an irrational thing, particularly on the anti-treaty side. And it does seem mystifying, especially how it got so bitter, why they were killing each other with such bitterness and such vindictiveness in the Civil War over what seemed to be minor points over the treaty, such as the oath of allegiance to the British monarch. Now, it starts to look a lot less kind of surprising when you look at the sort of events on the ground. You start to see the people were kind of overtaken by events. You start to see a lot less planning and a lot less intention for civil war and a lot more kind of muddle and sort of belligerence on both sides. But you start to see that the anti-treaty side provoked the government. They refused to acknowledge the government's supremacy over the IRA in April 1922. And they occupied the forecourts, of course. They also occupied a lot of other buildings around the country, particularly in the south. But you start to see that they're so badly prepared for civil war. They're still cooperating with the government on the north, for example. They've no plan, no military plan to seize the country. One or two people, like Tom Barry, did talk about that. But he was vetoed at a meeting of the IRA executive before the start of the civil war. As you get closer to it, you start to see so much more muddle that it becomes less a question of kind of clashing ideologies as just a terrible mess. On the pro-treaty side, one of the advantages the pro-treaty side had in the Civil War was that they had a much clearer idea of what they were trying to do. They were trying to implement the treaty and set up the Free State. So people like Arthur Griffith were very critical of Michael Collins for not moving against the anti-treaty IRA more quickly. As you get closer to it, basically, it becomes a lot more inexplicable. It doesn't become any less sort of tragic and wasteful than it was. But you start to understand it much more as the sort of product of events rather than something that was long planned by anyone.
And how do you think the people in general reacted to it? The general population who were not participants but were observing and sometimes being caught up in it.
I'll start off my answer with the usual historian's get out clause, which is that it's very difficult to generalise because, you know, what's true for some people isn't true for other people. Okay, so let's start with Dublin, okay, for example, which is one place that I've looked at. What you see in Dublin at the start, the fighting starts at the forecourts on O'Connell Street, is sort of shock and dismay from the general public, is my sense of it. That, you know, there's quotes from people like, it's terrible that they're shooting at each other. In the early part of the Civil War, the people seem to be very much on the pro-treaty side. Now, this is going by press reports and stuff like that, but the anti-treatyites also say this, especially in Dublin. They say, like Frank Sherwin, who was an anti-treaty fighter, who was captured in Dublin in the Civil War, said that the people were against us in the Civil War and you couldn't rely on anyone. You could only rely on safe houses of people you were 100% sure on, kind of thing. You couldn't knock on doors. You start to see, I think, people want law and order restored. They want an end to the Civil War. But as the Civil War goes on, and the longer the National Army, remember, the Free State Army is expanded from a very pretty small number of people, from about 4,000 to nearly 60,000 by the end of the Civil War. And as they come to occupy most of the country, they become really unpopular in a lot of places because they're very poorly trained, poorly paid in a lot of cases. A lot of them are trigger happy, a lot of them are drunk, a lot of them abuse the civilian population, especially when they're in an area where they're not from. Like in Tipperary, you see this. And in Kerry, you see this, especially from Dublin troops and actually Belfast troops as well. Belfast Republicans, I might add, strangely enough. You start to see in the dull from the Labour Party, you know, sort of dismay about the government's severity during the Civil War, their adoption of executions and arbitrary arrests. Habeas corpus, the right to a trial, was suspended during the Civil War. My sense of the thing on the ground is that at the start of the Civil War, the general public associates the pro-treaty side with law and order. And they want them to put an end to it quite quickly. Also, the other thing is, at the start of the Civil War, the rhetoric of the pro-treaty side is much more Republican than it is at the end. At the start of the Civil War, they're calling themselves the official IRA. it resonates with later times, but it was also used at that time. And at the end of the Civil War, they called themselves the National Army. You know, things like at the start of the Civil War, they called their men volunteers. And at the end of the Civil War, they called them privates in the British Army sense. But much more, I think, the public gets alienated from the behaviour of pro-treaty troops because they're quite undisciplined in a lot of the country. They're hard on civilians. They shoot civilians. They take stuff off civilians. They beat them up. They're rude to people at checkpoints, things like that. They're also, I mean, during the Civil War, there are many Republicans executed, of course, both in the field and officially. And there are kind of public funerals for these people. And the traditional nationalist imagery of martyrdom is displayed by the Republican side. And I think, I'm sure that created a certain amount of sympathy by the end of the Civil War. If you go by election results, the anti-treaty side does considerably better in 1923 than they did in 1922. And there's other reasons for that to do with election pacts and stuff. But my feeling is that people, they got this kind of a sympathy vote in 1923. People were less supportive of the pro-treaty side and its army than they were during the Civil War. But the other thing about the Civil War is that a lot of people sort of had a plague on both your houses attitude, because they might be visited at night, especially in rural areas. They might be visited at night by anti-treaty guerrillas who would demand supplies. They might be visited in the morning by pro-treaty soldiers who would kick in the door and ask, why did you give supplies to these irregulars? Urban areas, in Dublin and Cork especially, because in a city you can sort of hide if you're a guerrilla, there were gun attacks every night. So every night there'd be shootings and there'd be people killed and injured, civilians, apparently for no particular reason. They'd be going about their daily business and they'd be hit by a stray bullet. A lot of people were really sick and tired of this. And there's a lot of discourse in local papers and national papers, things like, you know, end this bloody conflict. And can people not just bury the hatchet kind of thing? And there's a certain sense of, like, you kind of political activists, you made the kind of nationalist revolution and now you're killing each other. And the ordinary person is sort of getting it in the neck. So in the election of 1923, though, there's roughly 30 to 40% of votes for people like the Labour Party and the Farmers Party and Independents. So to neither of the factions. Another interesting thing is that this is the second election with proportional representation, and there's quite a lot of votes across the pro-treaty divide. So I think that the division between pro-treatyite and anti-treatyite in the general population is kind of fluid. Like, people didn't want the Civil War to happen. Aside from the kind of partisans on both sides, most people didn't feel, I don't think, a clear allegiance to either side. I think, you know, we talk about Civil War politics, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. In my opinion, that was still kind of unformed. There was a core of that, of course, by the end of the Civil War. The Republicans saw themselves as the true Republicans, kind of the friend of the little man. They're going to represent the real people of Ireland, that the pro-treaty side were sellouts and that they represented the money classes. So you can still see the elements of this in Irish politics, but probably Sinn Féin have taken on this mantle more than Fianna Fáil now. And Fine Gael are, of course, a descendant of the pro-treaty side. And to an extent, they still do perceive themselves as their forefathers did in 1923 as the party of law and order, the party of moderate nationalism, things like this, the party of kind of security and stability. But to a large extent, though, I think that these attitudes were formed in the next two decades of the 20s and 30s as the kind of electoral politics got back into swing. And remember, and I stress again, because I talked before about the franchise, this is the first time that most Irish people have had the vote as opposed to a minority. So though the Civil War is important for forming political attitudes, it's probably not as important as it's sometimes given credit for. It's important in lots of other ways, I think, but it's not the only thing that formed the Irish political system, I don't think.
Well, what do you think are the biggest misconceptions about the Civil War? Not from historians, but just in general among people.
The Civil War in particular, the kind of popular version, well, there's two big mistakes. One is that the Civil War was about partition. Without going into all the ins and outs, the Civil War was not about partition. Both sides in 1922 were against partition, although neither side had a clear plan of doing anything about it. But the Civil War was something that broke out about how independent the Southern Irish state would be. So that's one mistake people often make. The other mistake is that, and especially this comes from things like Michael Collins, the movie, Neil Jordan's movie, and also sort of popular history version, which is kind of idly promoted in journalism and things like that, which is that the pro-treatyites were basically good Democrats and the anti-treatyites were bad potential dictators or, if you like, fanatics or militarists. And it's just, there's lots of problems with that. Let's just suffice to say it's so much more complicated than that, because on the one hand, the anti-treatyites never said that they wanted a dictatorship in Ireland, apart from the very odd utterance like of people like Rory O'Connor. And they adopted constitutional democratic politics almost immediately after the Civil War. De Valera had a bit of a battle with separating from Sinn Féin after and forming Fianna Fáil. But almost directly after the Civil War, even National Army Intelligence is saying that the irregulars are going for political methods, which is not something that militarist fanatics do, really. And on the other side, the pro-treaty side, the biggest problem with the idea that they're the good guys or the only good guys is that there's so many people on their side who are militarists, certainly equally militaristic as the other side, who believe that the army should be the one who's dictating the future of the nation. And elements of them, of course, tried a coup in 1924, which I mentioned towards the end of the book, and discussed the coup again. But they really started planning for a coup in 24 against the Free State government, for which they were arrested, principally Charles Dalton and Liam Tobin. And in 1932, elements of the Gardaí under Ona Duffy and the army under Hugo McNeill again discussed, although this didn't really get beyond that, a coup to stop Fianna Fáil coming to power. So if we're going to talk about people, militarists and people who believe in the gun over electoral politics, realistically, we have to look at both sides of the Civil War divide.
Well, thank you very much, John. We could talk for an awful lot longer on that subject, but that is John Dorney, my co-presenter and co-producer on the Irish History Show, talking about his new book, Peace After the Final Battle, The Story of the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1924. And that's available from New Island Books in all good bookstores, and ebooks as well, I presume. There's a launch for the book on the 7th of May at 6 p.m. in Connolly Books. And you have been listening to the Irish History Show on Near FM. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, go to the Near FM podcast page, or you could check out our Facebook page on facebook.com/the Irish History Show, or you could email us at history@near.ie. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on behalf of myself and John Dorney, thank you very much for listening to the show.